Ancient mysteries, doomsday theories, we've got it all. The power of 12. William Gladstone joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And Bill Gladstone back with us. He's a cultural anthropologist, expert in indigenous cultures. He's got degrees from Yale and Harvard. Can't get much bigger than that. Lead researcher for the Rod Serling late television series, Search of Ancient Mysteries. Bill has studied cultures all around the world, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Bill, how are you?
Wonderful. It's just so great to be on your show again.
Looking
George.
Forward
really
to this.
Enjoy the time we get to spend together.
How cool was it researching Search of Ancient Mysteries?
I have to say, I was 22 years old, just had graduated from Yale College, and this is before faxes. This is before the internet. This is before, you know, all the technology we have. And they actually dictated my contract over the phone. And part of the contract language, I've never forgotten, it said, William Gladstone is hired to search for ancient mysteries anywhere in the world it may take him.
I love it.
That was my job definition. I was 22. When I got to the airport, they had given me $500 for what they called magazine money. And it was at the time when Nixon had lifted the gold standard.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The currency devaluation in 24 hours was over $250 on my plane ticket, my round-the-world plane ticket. So it was good I had the magazine money and could get my plane ticket. It took them 2 hours to write it out. It was literally an around-the-world ticket. And even though I was only paid at that time $150 a week, my per diem was more than that. That's the, you know, what they gave
your daily,
food
yeah.
and daily allowance. And I got to, you know, travel first class all over the world and go to some of the most exotic places. Anyone, I mean, they don't even exist anymore. I actually, during that shoot, went to Machu Picchu and was one of the last people to be able to sleep in the ruins. It was before the hotel was built.
And this was done in what, 1973, wasn't it, as a television?
Yeah, I did. It was released in 1973, yes. I did the actual work in 72.
It was a one-time documentary film, wasn't it?
It was a one-time documentary film. But it was so successful that they played it twice a year for more than 20 years.
Wow.
At the time, it was the most lucrative documentary film ever aired on television. And I will brag a little bit. You know, I didn't know what I was doing, but I did a great job. And I came back under budget, ahead of schedule, and with so much extra footage that they actually turned it into what they call a four-wall. So they also showed it in theaters, an extended version of the documentary.
Did you have a chance to meet the man himself, Rod Serling?
I actually never did. Oh. I met all the people that worked with him, and I had indirect communication with him, but unfortunately, I never got to meet him.
So what a treat!
My memory is the same as everyone else who has watched those wonderful Twilight Zone shows. I mean, just a remarkable man, and someone that we lost much too soon.
God, he had a lot of magic, didn't he,
yeah.
William? Unbelievable. You really did. So where did your travels take you?
Well, we started off in Peru. Part of the reasons I got the job, and, you know, young people out there, just follow your dreams. I happen to love Spanish, and I majored in Spanish literature at Yale. I didn't get into anthropology in a major way until I went to Harvard. But because I majored in Spanish literature, I was fluent in Spanish, and I was originally hired just to do the research. And, of course, a lot of the research I did was locations in South America. And because I happened to speak Spanish, when it came time to decide who should be the production coordinator and go to all these sites and, you know, smooth things over so we get the crew in and everything else, they chose me because of my language facility. So we started in Peru, and, you know, I rented planes, and we went to the Nazca Lines. We went to the Rock of Sayuiti, where Ron Donegan had written about. We, you know, went to Cusco. We went to Machu Picchu. And many of the things that Eric Von Däniken had written about were, to put it mildly, exaggerated. For example, he described a cloud formation in Sayuiti, which is in the middle of nowhere, but there's this incredible rock, which is a model of an ancient city. And he claimed that, you know, the reason the rock was there was because the clouds in that area depicted a rocket ship. Well, that may or may not have been true twice a year at a very special time of the year, but it wasn't true when we were there. And just by coincidence, I happen to have the same taxi driver take me there as had taken Eric Von Däniken. And so, you know, I was only 22. I didn't really have anything on the line. So when I had a disaster like that, you know, oh my gosh, we're supposed to film here the next day. And we did film. But you know, we had to find a different storyline. While I was in Cusco, I happened to meet a professor who was an archaeologist who pointed out that he had a collection of skulls from 600-700 years ago that showed evidence of laser surgery.
Wow.
So we didn't find the rocket ship image that we were looking for, but we found signs of ancient technology that we do not understand how laser surgery was performed in the mountains of the Andes 600-700 years ago, but, you know, irrefutable proof that it was. So my take as the researcher was, my gosh, there's so many ancient mysteries out there, and they're not necessarily explainable by ancient astronauts, which was really the theme of the film. Now, I want, you know, to be balanced on this. I was actually a complete skeptic about UFOs and about extraterrestrial intelligence. I went to Harvard, I went to Yale, very conservative. Over the last 30, 40 years, I've actually changed my views, and I think that it may not be extraterrestrial contact in the way that, you know, is depicted on Close Encounters of the Third Kind and things like that, not necessarily actual beings, but that there is intelligence throughout the universe which is accessible. And my own research into the Mayan calendar indicates to me, number one, that the Mayan calendar was not created by the Mayans, and that the civilization that created that calendar, the Mayans were the popularizers of that calendar, must have had information that comes from, whether you want to call it the source, the Akashic Records, the zero point, but they must have had a way of accessing information, because mathematically it's much too accurate to have been stumbled upon by a bunch of uncivilized people just looking at the stars. That doesn't ring true. So I do think that despite my disagreement with a lot of the details of the Eric von Däniken theory, that there has been throughout possibly the last 10 to 20,000 years, some form of contact with what I would call extraterrestrial intelligence.
You know, I've always wondered, too, if we, one, had incredible technology because mankind was so old and something happened, they obliterated themselves, who knows what, or if it was direct ET, the source, and it came from that. It's either way. It's one or the other, as far as I'm concerned.
I think that that there's more evidence that is being uncovered, both from the point of view of quantum physics and string theory, that there is, in fact, what Borges used to call the Aleph. He was a fiction writer, and I think if he were alive today, he would say, no, I made it all up. But I think that he wasn't really making it all up, the same way that Jung talks about the collective unconscious and how. And Kroeber, the great anthropologist, the great American anthropologist, talked about the collective unconscious. What is the collective unconscious? And when we examine things like Claude Lévi-Strauss' great study of all the myths from throughout the world, particularly throughout South America, of peoples who had no way of having any physical contact, having identical myths, what is that about? Where is that coming from? His theory was there's a structure in the human brain that just sort of created it all. I think it's more probable that different people at different times have had access to the zero point and have downloaded similar information.
I think so, too. What did you think of the Nazca lines?
Unbelievable. I mean, again, clearly there was a belief that someone was watching us, because you can't, when you drive down there and there's no big mountain where you could have gone to see it, it's like, who was making these and why were they making them? They weren't making them for other human beings. They had to be making them because they either believed or there actually was, in their minds, somebody out there looking down upon these incredible lines.
I know. It's just remarkable. I was with Eric von Däniken several months ago, and he's just, you know, he was as fascinating then as he is now.
Well, he's a character. I've met with him a couple of times. I don't always agree with him, but, you know, God bless him. You know, I think he's made a major contribution to awakening awareness throughout the world.
Yeah, I think so, too. When we were last together, we talked about your work, The Power of 12, and let's go through that a little bit. That was tied into, of course, that December 21st, 2012 date, which has come and gone. But I think things are still out there, don't you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I have to say that my whole experience in writing novels is definitely paranormal. People sometimes say they channel when they write.
Yeah.
I have to say, in all modesty, my life was channeled so that I could write the books. It wasn't that I was channeling. because when I started out writing the 12, I had no intent to use myself as the basis for the main character. I had actually met a woman in 1979 who had a near-death experience that she came out of remembering 12 names. And like the character of Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters, she was obsessed with finding these people. In reality, one of the 12 people was someone that I knew. And so I became fascinated with her story and immediately wrote a screen treatment and was going to take it to Hollywood and have a film produced. And I actually got an agent and I got some interest. But then I was told, kid, you know, you're not going to have anything to do with the actual film. We like your idea, but we're going to run with it and we'll give you some money. But, you know, that's it.
That's it. You're out.
And yeah. I said, money's not that important to me. I'm going to go out and make my own money and I'll produce the film. I didn't quite make enough money because everything at the time, I probably could have produced a good film for $2 to $3 million. As time went on, it was $20-30 million to produce this film. So I never got around to doing it. And then I talked to some friends and they said, hey, you know, you're a great writer. Why don't you just write it as a novel? And of course, by then I had lost contact with the woman. I still remember her name, Glenda Finn, if she's still alive and out there. Contact us. I'd love to reconnect. But anyway, so I started writing it and I said, I can't find her. I had a very similar near-death experience. I'm going to base this around a character that I'm going to play off of me. And I made a fictional version of myself in the novel. It's called Max. And I recount my near-death experience, and then I go on from there. When I was done with the first draft of the novel, which originally I wasn't even sure was going to be a novel. I was going to, you know, call it memoir or prophecy. But then my publisher said, Bill, because I wrote it in 2008, you know, the conclusion happens in 2012. How can this be nonfiction? It hasn't even arrived.
Yeah.
It's got to be a novel. So I said, okay, well, that makes it easier. I'll change the names, make it into a novel. Fortunately, out of the blue, I was contacted by Stephanie South, who was at the time Jose Arguelles' wife.
Okay.
And
of course, he was the one who
started the
point. And he was
the harmonic convergence,
yep,
and drew all the attention to the Mayan calendar.
Exactly.
So I said, Stephanie, I'm delighted she was writing a biography of Jose. And I said, of course I'm delighted, because in my day job, I'm a literary agent. I represent authors. I said, I'll represent it, but I'd really appreciate it. Could you show Jose my manuscript? I'd love to get his take on it. So I get this email. I couldn't believe Jose, who I had never met, so there's nothing personal about it, writes back, I have no idea why I read your novel. I have no time to read anybody else's work, let alone a novel. But you did have 2012 in the title, so I thought, I'll give it a look.
Why not?
Yeah. Well, I couldn't put it down, but most importantly, in a parallel universe, you and I are the same being, because the message that you brought about the meaning of the Mayan calendar is exactly the message that I, as I think he called himself Popol Vuh, I'm not sure exactly what, but I'm forgetting the name of the primary Mayan lord who Jose felt that he was incarnating.
Pakal?
I believe so.
Lord Pakal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you have brought through, as purely as anyone I've ever read, the real meaning of the Mayan calendar. And so I went back, and then he told me some other things about the book that I hadn't realized. I mean, I had written the book, but I didn't understand the book as well as he did. And when I went back, I started to see amazing coincidences about my life, about, you know, just incidents that had happened that were truly extraordinary. I don't want to give them away because people who haven't read the book yet, it will spoil the book.
Right, we don't want to do that.
But, you know, at the end of the experience, I realized, and I went down to Mexico, the book sold, you know, hundreds of thousands of copies all over the world in many different languages. And particularly when I was in Mexico, actually had an experience of ancient beings coming to me. I happened to my wife is a clair, I don't know what you call it, communicates with the unseen dimension.
Oh, it's like the dead?
No, the,
okay,
well,
so she was, I guess she could be a channeler or medium.
She does a lot of different things, but she sees through the veil.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was giving a speech in Mexico City, she described to me these beings. I did not see them because I do not have this gift. She said, they're very tall. They're about 8 to 12 feet tall, and they're here to protect you and to thank you for writing your novel. And I believe that these are the actual beings that downloaded the information that became the Mayan calendar. So moving forward, the Mayan calendar never predicted the end of the world. All this doomsday was Hollywood creation. They made a lot of money with the film, and you know, people are fascinated by doomsday, and I know we're going to talk more about why people are fascinated.
Mm-hmm.
But The real intent of the Mayan calendar was to bring attention to the fact that a 26,000-year cycle has just ended.
That's right.
And a new 26,000-year cycle is beginning. The way I like to describe, because people say, well, I don't see any difference. I say, well, think of 26,000 years as a single day. Then think of the 10 seconds before the sun sets and the 10 seconds after the sun has set. Unless you're staring directly at the sun, you don't even know the difference between the 10 seconds before and the 10 seconds after. So if you look at it in 26,000 years, since approximately the year 2000, we've already been in this change, and we're going to be in this change for at least another 10 to 20 years. And this change period is a window of opportunity to switch our focus from what the Mayan, and because I've also talked with Mayan shaman after I met with Jose and realized I had a connection to the Mayan, is about switching the overemphasis on material, short-term success towards more spiritual values. And the easiest way for us to think about it in our nomenclature would be a shift from a male spiritual base to a female spiritual base. But it's really more about balance. The great male energy has really produced all this fabulous technology. I mean, you cannot criticize the way, you know, we live today. Probably the poorest among us has more material ease and comfort than the richest king 10,000 years ago.
No, there's no question about it.
So, you know, I don't want to condemn the path that we've been on. But at the same time, the path that we've been on has reached absurdity. We can't keep going in this direction and expect this planet to maintain a sustainable lifestyle that's actually enjoyable for the 7 billion people, which could, you know, become 10 billion people in short order, unless we change our priorities. And the priorities have to start being more about nurturance, more about sharing, more about aesthetics, and less about short-term material accumulation. Greater awareness that we are all connected. The internet, more than anything, I think has shown us how connected we are. Something that happens in a remote country, such as Greece, affects us immediately. We almost had our whole world economy collapse when Greece was about to go under.
And there's instant information.
And
I mean, I remember.
You have the event in Japan. You have earthquakes.
Michael Jackson died. It was
instant.
Exactly.
And we're all affected. So we really are starting to become aware of our collective consciousness in the moment, not 10 years after the moment. So there's a lot of good things about where we are right now. There's a lot of challenges. The interesting sort of unknown is free will, because even though the Mayan and other civilizations, the Hawaiian, the Hopi, the Tibetan, the Vedics back in India, have all prophesied that the end of one cycle is the beginning of a better cycle, where, you know, in different cultures, some have called it the end of the Iron Age, the beginning of the gold, you know, every culture has their own way of doing it. But the majority of ancient cultures believe that we're about to enter something that would, if you're, you know, a follower of the Bible, be heaven on earth. That potential is there, but there's no certainty that we're going to do it because we have free will. And there are probably, as scientists are discovering, multiple universes. So we may choose the wrong one to experience, and it's up to us which choice we make.
We're going to come back, William, continue talking about this. I want to get more of your take on the fact that 2012 has come and gone, and that we're in this new cycle, what that all means. I always thought it would be something to do with the sun. Ironic, we're in a solar maximum, and we're really in a minimum. Nothing's going on at all. And then later on, we'll talk with William Gladstone about his thoughts about doomsday theories, all of that on Coast to Coast AM. And Bill Gladstone, our special guest, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you. Hey, by the way, have you had a chance to watch the television show Beyond Belief? Our show, you can do that. Great guests, 10 days free. Simply go to this website, www.beyondbelief.com. Beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. Bill Gladstone with us. Bill, you know, I was one of them that got caught up in the 2012 situation. How did so many people get into it, most of them thinking it was going to be a disaster?
Well, I think part of the reason is the hype that came not just from Hollywood, but from a lot of different groups that have made enormous profits from selling bunkers, from frightening people that they needed to buy dry goods and, you know, be prepared for an apocalyptic event. Now, it's not impossible that there will be an apocalyptic event eventually, and certainly, you know, living in California, everyone should be prepared for earthquakes. We know we're going to get them. But there really is a small group of people that are interested in profiting from the fears that are created from doomsday scenarios. And so that's part of the reason for the popularity of doomsday. The other reason I believe that doomsday scenarios are so popular is that from the point of view of an apocalyptic doomsday, we're all equal. Bill Gates is no more protected than you or I, or, you know, the lowest, you know, service person at a gas station or a 7-Eleven. So we're all the same, and there's a certain comfort, even though you know you're going to be destroyed, in knowing that you're not going to be destroyed any sooner than anyone else, even the richest man on the planet. So I think, you know, those are just two small reasons why everyone picked up on the doomsday. Then you also have just the jokers. Oh, you know, the Mayan calendar ends, so that must mean that they believe that the world was going to end. There's actually, in all of the writings that have been studied, and unfortunately there's not a lot of them because the Spanish conquistadors really destroyed almost all of the artifacts from the Mayan civilization. But there's nothing in any of the Mayan writings that indicated that the world was going to end. So, you know, it really was not based on scientific evidence at all.
Now, some people, though, did they feel this energy shift at all?
I believe that yes, absolutely, some people. But I really, you know, think it's very, very small percentage, because it really has to do with the level of vibration. Each one of us is the same on one level, but on a different level, we're all at different levels of evolution and awareness. Certainly the great, you know, teachers, whether we're talking about the Dalai Lama or you know, sadhus in India, people that have really dedicated most of their life to meditation and to trying to connect to what we would call the zero point, are vibrating at a higher frequency. And I think for some of those people, they probably have been aware. On a less sort of mass esoteric level, I think that many of us are aware that life is quickening, that there has been tremendous change in the last 10 to 20 years on this planet. But I think very few of us are so sensitive that we necessarily detected that moment on December 21st, 2012 of change. It would be the equivalent in my other analogy of someone looking at the sun, someone who is at the sunset and seeing the change, feeling the change. Very few people are at that level.
Very few indeed. Now, you have looked at, through this, and I can't wait until next hour, we'll talk about these doomsday scenarios here, but you've also looked at the multiverses, the theories of extra parallel universes out there, haven't you? What do you think of that?
Well, I think that there's mounting evidence that it's not fantasy or conjecture, but reality. One of my mentors is Dr. Irvin Laszlo, who's written about the Akashic paradigm. He calls it the zero point, and it's very similar to the ancient beliefs that were popular in India of the existence of Akashic records. And these Akashic records hold all the information, both past, present, and future, and somehow exist in a non-space space that is actually accessible. Now, you add to that the probability that there are actually not just multiple universes, but potentially infinite universes, and it becomes beyond anything that a human being can comprehend. It would be the equivalent of a computer that is storing all information backwards, forwards, with infinite variety. I actually, in my new novel, The Power of 12, speculate on how this could be real. And in a novel, you have a lot of freedom. So I've created a holographic Akashic record reader and some other devices that get into the very real possibility that there are parallel universes existing that are identical in every aspect, but minor differences based on choices that each of us has made.
So you and I are in this parallel universe doing our thing. Maybe the roles are reversed, but we're out there?
They could be reversed, or it could just be a minor difference where the government didn't shut down last week and everything is rolling along in a smoother manner because of decisions other people have made. And in my novel, I talk about Earth 769, and I have, you know, what happens on Earth 769 stays on Earth 769. But because of the Mayan calendar, and the wrinkle in time that was created by the completion of a 26,000-year cycle, not just on our planet, but also as it affects the alignment of other planets and possibly other universes, there's a leak in the negative thought forms. And ultimately, if everything is consciousness, which is where science is headed, thought forms themselves may be the most important single element in determining the future of our planet and our universe.
You know, is it also possible that these parallel universes, Bill, could be like time warps in that one of them could be the past, another could be going on right now like we are, another one could be the future, and it's all laid out that way?
Well, if you read the Seth Speaks book, there's a lot of evidence, you know, because where do people come up with these ideas? I mean, you know, it's not just one brain sort of thinking something up randomly. The information is coming from somewhere. So I think there is a grain of truth in almost all science fiction and all books that have been channeled. And I think what you've just said is absolutely true. I think that there are multiple universes coexisting, and our ability to determine if we're living in a present universe or a past universe or a future universe is actually outside of our ability to determine in the moment.
The fact that scientists have been able to theorize that there could be multiple universes just boggles my mind, Bill.
Well, there, I don't know if you saw Nova did a great series on this, and it's even more than anyone has presented yet, because you take everything that has been discussed and then you add the concept of infinity to it. Most human beings can't comprehend what infinity really means.
No, I can't comprehend the Big Bang.
It would mean that every single version of the universe that you and I are inhabiting at this time, all of the experiences that we've had over the last 4 or 5 decades, however long we've been on this planet, exist with variations, with infinite variations. And when you start thinking of life in that way, and having had a near-death experience where I did experience absolute bliss consciousness, you realize that life is not exactly what your mama and papa told you and your teachers. It's not this linear existence that starts, ends, and doesn't have a purpose. There really is a purpose to everything. And I would say that from the point of view of divine intelligence, the purpose is to evolve into ever greater complexity and aesthetic enjoyment for the mere miracle and joy of existence itself.
You know, when my mother was telling me, trying to teach me about God when I was a little boy, I think what she did, and not even knowing it, she was telling me about the universe, because she would always tell me, George, God always was, always will be. And I think, and she didn't know this, I think she was describing the universe.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, because I had a relationship where my mother, even though she was officially most of her life an atheist and then broke down, became an agnostic, had an ability to capture the value of nature in a way that was extremely spiritual. My father was a chemist, and he was really, even though he was a big supporter of, you know, the Jewish faith, actually not a believer at all. He, as a chemist, because at the end of his life, I said, "So, Dad, what? How do you see things going for me?" He says, "Well, I'm a chemist. I know what's going to happen. All my molecules are going to disintegrate, decompose, and they'll be reabsorbed in, you know, other physical experiences. But that's it. That's all there is." Because different people who are trained to look at different aspects of reality really limit themselves to that aspect of reality. Having had a near-death experience, I experienced what it is when people say we're not human beings having a spiritual experience, but spiritual beings having a human experience, because the spiritual being is eternal. I mean, I experienced what it's like, and I know you've had other guests on your show. Danian Brinkley is probably the most outspoken and articulate. And what Danian describes, because he said, I think, 3 near-death experiences,
three of them.
Exactly what I experienced. And once you've had that experience, it does change the way you relate to your daily life. As a human being, I'm just like everybody else. I want to win. I want my books to be bestsellers. I want to enjoy my golf, my tennis, live in a beautiful house, drive a nice car, and all that's normal. But I'm also aware at the same time that I'm pursuing those human goals that I'm a spiritual being and that I'm really part of everything that is. I'm not just you, George. I'm everyone. And I'm not just other people. I'm animals. I'm plants. I'm connected in a very real way that is beyond my human consciousness even. And that this connection is ultimately more important than the human personality, William Gladstone, which no matter what I achieve in my human life, 1,000 years from now, I doubt anyone's going to remember. And I think we all need to keep this context because then we'll start treating each other better. There's an old Indian guru who wrote a book called I Am That, and there's great wisdom in that. When you look at something outside of yourself, you really are looking at yourself because on the highest level, you are connected to all of existence and all matter. And even our distinction between animate and inanimate is actually subjective. It's what we in the Western world believe. Indigenous cultures don't necessarily believe that. I have friends, ancient Hawaiian shaman, who described for me the pain that the mountain felt in Kauai when it was leveled to make the airport. I mean, there's different levels of awareness that different groups of human beings have had, many levels which have been lost over time. And part of this new cycle, this new awareness that the Mayan calendar is heralding, is about returning and then balancing this ancient wisdom with our practical, you can do it, go get them, you know, behavior, which I'm very proud of. You know, I'm a good capitalist, entrepreneur, American. I believe in the basic American values, but I also believe that it's time that we balance those values with a much more responsible, mature, and nurturing focus.
What do you think is the cause? How was this created? I mean, we're all connected. There's obviously intelligence out there in the universe. None of this is random. I don't believe it at all. Mm-hmm. But how? How in the heck did it happen?
Well, that's the fun. I mean, I think we spend our whole life learning a little bit by bit how it happened. I think that it is ultimately knowable, but I don't think it's knowable in one lifetime. I think that that's part of the soul's journey.
I agree.
And I think that it's fun to discover this, and it's fun to wake up. It's like you keep waking up to higher and higher levels of awareness. And each level encompasses the best that you were holding on to and allows you to grow. This is one of the reasons why I actually feel that the biggest danger facing humanity right now is fundamentalism. And I'm not just talking about Muslim fundamentalism. It can be evangelical fundamentalism. It can be Jewish orthodoxy. It can even be scientific fundamentalism. It can be political fundamentalism, but fundamentalism is a belief that everything is already written, that there's no evolution happening. There's no growth. That is really worshiping death.
The book is already there.
Yeah. If you believe that everything has already happened, what's the point of being here? Why are you here? You're here for a purpose. You're here to grow. You're here to communicate. You're here to learn. And if you think everything was already known because some people got together and wrote a book and said, this is it. Well, there's some great books that have been written. I'm not, you know, denigrating the Bible, the Quran, any of the Veda, the Bhagavad Gita.
I understand.
But that truth was truth in that moment, and truth continues to evolve. And after I worked for Rod Serling, I went around the world, made another movie called In Search of the Historical Jesus. And I interviewed all of the great religious leaders of our time, including the Dalai Lama. And the majority of these religious leaders had become businessmen just promoting the existence of their particular brand of religion. And yet, all of them, when I really pushed them, ended up having two or three basic beliefs that were identical, absolutely identical. And to think that people have been killing themselves for centuries because one was a Hindu and one was a Muslim and one was a Catholic is absolutely absurd. Because the reality, particularly if you look at the Muslims and the Jews, they're the same people, basically, from a genetic point of view. And the differences are so minor in their actual belief systems. And things have just gotten so out of whack. And it's really deplorable. I mean, there's been so much human suffering. And if you look at it, it's been caused by one thing, and it's human fear and greed.
But you think we'll get the answer, but on the other side.
Well, the ultimate answer, yes, but I think that there's the potential of becoming better human beings every single day, every single one of us. And I think that we can and we must solve these problems now. We can't wait 50 years. If we wait 50 years, this planet will not be a planet that any of us today would even want to be living on.
Well, that's true. And that's one of the things we'll talk about soon as we talk about doomsday theories that are everywhere, from the apocalypse to you name it. And that's another interesting thing. Why do so many cultures all seem to have the same ultimate conclusion? And that's finale time.
Well, because it's irrefutable that eventually this planet, just like our sun, will cease to exist. The reality, though, is the time frame is in the hundreds of millions, if not billions of years. And yet fundamentally, yes, it's true. There is going to come a day when life on this planet will cease to exist, but it is very far off into the future. Unfortunately, it could be not so far off in the future if we continue to basically deny the realities of science. I mean, global warming is not a myth. We are polluting our world. We are taking actions which are not sustainable. We are continuing to focus on growth, growth, growth. I mean, any company will tell you the bottom line is the only thing that matters, or is certainly the most important thing that matters, and the way to have a better bottom line is to sell more of whatever you're producing. This growth, growth, growth mentality made great sense back in, you know, the 18th and 19th centuries. We had manifest destiny here on North America. We had unlimited land. We could just keep expanding. And we had, relatively speaking, a very small population on the Earth. That is no longer the case. If we just double our population in the next 50 years, there's going to be over 14 billion people on this planet. If, unless we come up with ways of producing energy that have nothing to do with fossil fuels, it will not be sustainable. And no one, even a 100 billionaire, is going to be able to create an environment in which they will actually enjoy life.
No, probably not. William, what's new with you these days? What have you been working on?
Well, I just finished The Power of 12, in which a lot of these ideas, and actually ideas, I was listening to the in-between on the Coast to Coast AM promos, and I do talk about the Illuminati, and I do talk about GMO, and I talk about conspiracy theories, and I talk about George Bush, and all of these themes are woven into a very entertaining, lighthearted 200-page novel, which has elements of science fiction, though I have to question whether it's really science fiction, because as I learned with my last novel, somewhere, somehow, I am being led to write certain things that probably have greater meaning and import than I even realize. In this particular novel, it's called The Power of 12 because they introduced the concept of the Council of 12. In my case, I chose the planet Naranjada, which is actually a planet that I visited in an out-of-body experience. So the planet itself I know is real. I've actually had it confirmed from other people, and it is an orange planet, and so there's elements of reality. The Council of 12, of course, I completely made up, but maybe I didn't. Because after I wrote the novel, I was contacted by someone who said, oh, yes, I communicate with the Council of 12 daily.
So, there you go.
I don't really know. But the novel itself is about, you know, traditional battle between good and evil. We have the Illuminati, the grand light and keeper of the code of the Illuminati is Arnold Wheeler Dealer. He thinks he's a good guy. He thinks he's protecting the world.
Well, we're going to have to get you back for that. But let's get into these doomsday theories next on Coast to Coast AM.